Public Service Project, a collection of public service origin stories. I'm Kate Dallaire, and I'm lucky enough to be able to talk with current and former public servants to better understand who they are, what shaped them, and why they chose a path of service. What's the point? We're connecting one human and one story at a time. We're revisiting why we chose careers in service and what that says about us, our families, and our communities, and about America. We're not oversimplifying. We're not reducing anything to a soundbite. We're not spinning any kind of narrative. We're just being and reflecting on our own lives with honesty and curiosity. And this in itself is a radical act. I think it's exactly what we need. My guest today is Josh Black. I'm so excited to have him here. Josh Black served as Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for Multilateral Affairs on the National Security Council staff at the White House from 2023 to 2024. In this role, he advised President Biden on United Nations policy and managed the NSC Directorate responsible for the United Nations and international organizations, global criminal justice, and the global refugee protection. Josh started his career as a Presidential Management Fellow in the year 2000, and over the past quarter century, he's been a true advocate for multilateral approaches to reducing conflict and advancing U.S. national security interests around the world. Highlights include serving on the U.S. negotiating team for nuclear talks with Iran and leading negotiations on major U.N. Security Council resolutions addressing Iran and North Korea's nuclear programs, the 2011 conflict in Libya, the civil war in South Sudan, and the rise of ISIS. I could go on, but frankly, Josh, I'm tired. Your resume is too long. So welcome to the show, and thank you for being here.
Thank you, Kate. And, you know, I just am so glad you are doing what you are doing right now. We're living through tumultuous times. And I know that for a lot of us, I've thought more in the last couple of months about what it means to be a public servant, what it means to give back to a community. I've had an endless number of coffees with colleagues who are unemployed in Washington, by their own volition or not. But this is, I think, an important time to really think about what it means to give back, whether it's through government service or other ways to serve your community. So thank you for doing this, Kate. That's really important.
Of course. Thank you so much. And I'm really curious to start our conversation by just hearing your public service origin story. Where did all this start for you?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, as you noted, it's been 25 years that I've been involved in foreign affairs and international affairs. You know, when I think about my origins, I'm from Toledo, Ohio, you know, a Rust Belt town. My parents were teachers. We didn't travel internationally growing up for the most part. And I had parents who were of a generation where, on the one hand, they lived through the 60s. They went through a really idealistic time. My mom was and still is a staunch feminist. My parents fought for racial equality. And for them and for their generation, the war in Vietnam was a very searing experience, you know, war that they felt was unjust, where they saw people their own age being drafted and dying. And then they went through the Watergate experience in the 70s, which created a lot of cynicism about government and the bad things that government can do both at home and abroad. So on the one hand, I was raised with that sense of idealism that, you know, it is your responsibility to give back to a community, to fight for things that are right. I didn't quite inherit their distrust of government in quite the same way. I always have believed that government, federal government service, is a way to do good in the world. And so, you know, I mentioned that my family, we didn't really travel internationally, but my mom cobbled together some money when I was a teenager to send me on two trips to Europe alone, one when I was 15, one when I was 16. And I spent some time in the UK, and I spent some time in France and Spain. And I think for a lot of people in foreign affairs, you have that first trip overseas, and just your world blows open. And yeah. You see the possibilities. You see yourself in a new way. You understand what it means to be an American in a brand new way. So those were really transformative experiences. And in school, I was fascinated by the Spanish language. I studied it as an undergrad at Ohio State. I interned in D.C. for the first time when I was 20. And that's also, I think, an experience a lot of public servants have. You know, that you come from places like Toledo, you come to Washington, D.C., and you're just surrounded by all of these ambitious people who are trying to change the world. They're working in Congress. They're working in the federal government. They're working for NGOs, civil society groups. It was really exciting. The main influence, though, and I think where I got my motivation and my real start, I went to the School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton University, which is a relatively small program, but it really has an ethos. It's a program that believes in training people for careers in public service. Had a big international focus. It was close to New York City, so that meant close to the United Nations. I actually interned at the United Nations Association, over 25 years ago. And so that was really where I got my first start. As I went into government, as you noted, I came in on this program called the Presidential Management Fellowship. And this was 2000. So it was just about 1 year after the horrible war in Kosovo, where NATO had intervened to basically stop a looming genocide and ethnic cleansing of the ethnic Albanians in Kosovo. So here I am. I think I was 24 when I started that job. So I was very young. I come to the State Department. I hadn't traveled much internationally, except for those two trips as a teenager. And my first job in the State Department was to help demobilize the Kosovo Liberation Army, basically the guerrillas that fought the war in 1999. And these were some rough guys. Some of them were roughly my age. They were in their 20s. They had just fought this war. And some of them were up to no good. Some of them just wanted to restart their lives and serve Kosovo. And so 24 years old, I'm in the mountains with my, wingtips sinking into the mud in an armored vehicle driving me around. I mean, it was absolutely nuts that I was doing this. But the other experience I had, and I think this is common for a lot of public servants, very quickly I connected with some of the real people I met. And what was most impactful for me was people my age, who just the year before, they were refugees. Mm-hmm. They'd spent the night in a field in Macedonia. They remember being driven out of their homes or seeing dead bodies or just that fear. And it was a searing, searing experience. I ended up living in Kosovo for a while. I was actually there on 9/11, which was a very emotional experience for everybody. And then professionally, you want to kind of move around and work on different issues. I was so gripped by that issue. I spent almost 8 years working on the former Yugoslavia in different ways. And the accomplishment of which I was so proud, I worked on the negotiations that basically led to Kosovo becoming independent in 2008. From the country of Serbia. And in one of the great moments of not just my professional life, but my personal life, I was in the room when Kosovo declared its independence in February of 2008. This just extraordinary moment, watching a nation be born and feeling that I had helped, I had been a part of that, I had played a role in these world historic events. I have done a lot of work at the UN. I think I'm the UN guy now. After Kosovo independence, I decided I needed a big break. And one of my great dreams was to live in New York City. I'd been around the UN for a very long time. And I took a job that didn't sound very interesting to me. I was the head of the Sanctions and Counterterrorism Unit at the United States Mission to the United Nations. I knew very little about sanctions, sounded kind of boring, but I thought, okay, this is a chance to get to New York, experience multilateral diplomacy. I never expected to love that job as much as I did. And I spent almost 10 years there. I worked on counterterrorism, the rise of ISIS. Within a few months of me arriving, this is when President Obama had just come into office. We had major crises with North Korea and its nuclear weapons program. We had a big push to impose more sanctions on Iran, including at the United Nations. And then just the pleasure of working at the UN. The UN is this smorgasbord of every culture in the world, and especially working on the UN Security Council, where you have 10 elected members, so you have rotating members coming on and off, you got to be introduced to a whole new set of colleagues every year and get to learn a new culture. The diplomats inevitably would take you to their favorite restaurants in Manhattan. The Italians would take you to the best Italian food. The Koreans would take you out in Koreatown. And I really loved the work and it was meaningful. And as you noted, that really culminated for me in being able to advise Secretary John Kerry when we were doing the Iran nuclear talks exactly 10 years ago. It was hard. It was miserable. Sitting in stuffy rooms in poorly ventilated European hotels with Iranians that were a little grumpy. But we worked at it for months and months and months, and we got the deal. And that was also just like that day of Kosovo independence. The day we got that deal was just one of the most special days of my life, feeling that we had done something good for the world, for American security. I leveraged that to go to the White House for the first time. So I was the director for multilateral affairs at the tail end of the Obama administration. And I cannot begin to describe how special that experience was. The first time I was in the Oval Office with President Obama, I don't remember anything that happened. It was just this special experience.
Did
I couldn't
black out a little bit.
Oh my gosh, it was just crazy. And it was doubly special for me because I worked for Susan Rice twice. So I worked for her when she was our ambassador to the UN, and then I worked for her again when she was our national security advisor for Obama. So to be there with Susan, this extraordinary mentor and just great legendary figure, and President Obama at the same time, it was just a really special time traveling with him to the UN General Assembly, being in the presidential motorcade for the first time, and working on a lot of issues that were close to my heart, and really getting to understand the UN system and all the different alphabet soup of UN agencies and working on important issues. However, I said I was there at the tail end of the Obama administration. You may recall we had an election in 2016.
And I vaguely recall.
I'll tell you, the day going to work, the day after that election in 2016 was one of the more surreal things I'd ever experienced. And it was a shock. Everyone kind of remembers that. Susan Rice and President Obama, they were committed to have the most professional transition that we could do. And so we worked hard to try to prepare the next team for success. I actually was in the first Trump White House for about almost 4 months, trying to help the new team get up to speed and transition to a new set of folks. It was a pretty chaotic transition. And by the way, my work on the Iran nuclear deal actually put a bullseye on my my back. You know, they had all convinced themselves that that was a bad deal because that's what Trump said it was. So at this point, I'd been in federal government service for 18 years, and I decided to leave. And it was terrifying. I just thought I'd be the kind of person who would, you know, be a civil servant, retire at a certain age, and that would be my life, and it would be quite fulfilling. But I decided because of my values, who I was, the issues I cared about, that I just couldn't do that from within the first Trump administration. So it took me a while to find another gig, but I eventually found a fantastic role working with American drug companies doing global health work throughout the world. I got to travel a lot. I got to understand the private sector and how they work, worked with some really dynamic colleagues. But from the day I left government, I always knew I wanted to be back in the game. And that was my mission. That was what motivated me. And in 2020, that dark year where we had COVID and George Floyd and Trump and protests and everyone's head was exploding, we put together a small work group for the Biden campaign. Very informal. It was a team focused on UN multilateral affairs, where we would spend a couple nights a week. Everyone's on lockdown. You didn't have anything else to do. And we would spend these nights on Zooms talking about how we were going to bring things back, what we were going to do to rebuild if President Biden should be elected. And so, you know, one night we talk about the United Nations and human rights. How are we going to fix that? How are we going to re-engage? How are we going to fix UN peacekeeping? What are we going to do? It's a really important tool. You have tens of thousands of UN peacekeepers worldwide. How are we going to reform and update the membership of the UN Security Council, which has 5 permanent members that just happened to be the winners of a war 80 years ago? It needs to be reformed. And so those were the kinds of debates that we had in 2020. And so the plan was to come back And that's what I did. I spent the first 2 years of the administration working for Ambassador Linda Thomas Greenfield, one of America's great diplomats and a truly amazing human being, a real inspirational colleague, someone I'm so glad I got to work with. But there was one problem. Everyone's trying to kind of find the right job as a new government comes in. And the job that was open on her team was for Europe. It was essentially to be her Europe advisor. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I started my career in the Western Balkans. I thought, okay, it's a good fit. But I thought Europe, that's going to be kind of boring. You know, all the focus in this administration is going to be the Indo-Pacific. You know, a friend of mine said, well, maybe something will happen in Cyprus. You know, I mean, it just didn't seem like a portfolio where there was going to be a lot of action. Right. And then, you know, I will just never forget what it was like the tail end of 2021 when we started getting these really compelling indications that Putin was going to invade Ukraine and launch this war of aggression. So to be a part of the response at the UN to that was very, very, very fulfilling. Hmm. And then, you know, the last 2 years of the administration, I had the best job I have ever had in my life, which was to be senior director for multilateral affairs at the White House. We had an amazing team. The teams there are pretty small, only a handful of folks, but we had responsibility for all things under the sun at the UN. We also worked on global refugee protection. I had some amazing opportunities to meet refugees who were coming to the United States, meet refugees in places like South Sudan in the field. Again, that human connection that makes these jobs so worthwhile. Yeah. And we also worked on global criminal justice, so holding war criminals accountable throughout the world. And so that set of issues, working for Jake Sullivan, working for the president, was so fulfilling. It was so fun. And to bring the story, I guess, to a little up to date, I am now unemployed. I still get invited to stuff. I was at a dinner and everyone's going around giving their affiliations. And I said, hi, I'm Josh Black. Unemployed. And the dinner host said I should introduce myself as a thought leader. That sounds better than, you know, just unemployed. So I don't know what's next for me.
Yeah.
And like a lot of people in this town, I'm, you know, looking at opportunities, and maybe it's the private sector, maybe it's think tank mm-hmm. or advocacy world. But I can tell you that as of today, I miss the game.
Yeah,
I want to be back. And there's a lot of folks in this town who are already starting to think about, you know, how are we going to reinvigorate multilateralism? How are we going to bring this form of diplomacy back when the time is right? So yeah. That's my story. That's the origin story, Kate.
I love it. And I don't want to undermine your dinner host, but I would advise against calling yourself thought leader only because it's what everyone's doing on LinkedIn right, today. So you need a new term. But that said, I will say, I think you are truly a thought leader and one of the most committed multilateralists that I've ever met. And this is one reason why I really wanted to talk to you, because as you know, during my time at the State Department, I worked on UN issues and worked on peacekeeping.
Yes.
And I always found your thoughts on multilateralism to be so inspiring, because you can kind of tell the difference between people who are working on multilateral issues or people who truly believe in multilateralism. And so I want to go there and ask you a question about that in a second. But I also want to connect with you on this one point and say, I'm also a kid who came from like a suburban town outside Washington. I was in upstate New York, and my very first trip overseas was to the Central African Republic with State Department. So, you know, and I was, you know, I had like armored vehicle protection, UN around me, and I'm like, this is wild. This is exactly what I signed up for. But, you know, when you grow up kind of aspiring to travel and dreaming of the world kind of beyond where you are, and you have that curiosity and that hunger, I think that propels a lot of people into this kind of work. And so part of why I like to hear people's stories is because it helps push back against the notion that everybody who works in Washington is just of Washington and has grown up with all these privileges, when in reality, so many people come from all around the country to try to bring their unique skills and serve and bring, you know, their own backgrounds and their own lived experiences to the table. So I love that we share that.
Can I respond to that? Because, you know, in Washington, you probably have heard this knock against Washington, that when you go to a party you go to a bar, one of the first questions you're asked is, what do you do? You know, what do you do?
Oh, yeah.
And it's usually kind of like in a negative way. Like, look at all those climbers, you know, who are you know, trying to judge each other by, you know, perceived status. I've never looked at it that negatively. I think the reason in Washington people ask that question, it's because unlike in a lot of places, what you do really engages your values. Mm-hmm. It really is an important part of you. I lived in New York for many years, you know, working at the UN. And, you know, people who are in finance, you know, they might like it, but it doesn't quite, you know, define who they are or reflect some kind of, you know, inner core in the same way that, say, you know, someone who's working at Human Rights Watch or someone who's, you know, working on the Hill for a senator they really believe in. So I like you, I find that milieu amazing. And also you mentioned, you know, people coming from other areas. One of the best, smartest things that I think the State Department has done is in recent years, they now pay their interns.
Yes. I was part of the last unpaid cohort.
Oh, it's hard. Tell me about it. It was a tough summer. And when you think about it, unpaid internships in these fields are a real obstacle to mobility.
Yeah.
Because it's the kids of, you know, rich parents who get these opportunities. And we had some of the just most outstanding interns that came from all over the country who had this opportunity, and they're now, I hope, will go on and give back in their own ways.
Well, you know, what's the only reason I was able to intern and get a foot in the door and then kind of lead to the awesome job that I had at State was because it was COVID when I was interning.
Oh, okay.
So that was part of the remote internship cohort then, and that made it possible for me because I was a mom of three living in North Carolina. So it wasn't going to be possible for me to just kind of come to Washington for a semester. And so really, that was a silver lining of a really challenging time and opened some doors for me, too. But I like what you said about the fact that people in Washington ask what you do because it says so much about what you value. And I also was thinking it's interesting because then if you're kind of hanging out in intelligence circles, then no one asks what you do because they know it's off limits. So it's how many kids do you have? Where have you traveled? But anyway, to get to my multilateralism question, because you're the perfect person for this, I really think we can believe in the purpose that the UN serves and at the same time question how it performs and want to be a part of reforming things, as you said, making it work better for Americans, but for everybody in the world. And at the same time, I think one of the great challenges of this moment is that there are powerful incentives to weave a narrative that somehow disagreeing with the way that the UN operates on behalf of its member states' interests means that we should kind of just like disregard the UN or multilateralism in general as a viable solution for advancing our own national interests. You have been fighting the good fight for so many years. How do you square this? What do you say to people who are not exactly believers in multilateralism about why it's not really an option to collectively address these challenges?
No, I mean, it's a fantastic question. And this has really become my life's mission is to talk about multilateralism, help Americans, I think, understand better what value we get out of this system. And to your point, there's a lot of lots of parts of the system that don't work very well and that really need to be fixed. I guess I would make a few points at the outset. First, when you live in a super complicated world like we do now, virtually every problem is multilateral, right? It's a matter of getting large groups of countries together to mobilize resources, to solve problems, to, you mentioned peacekeeping, to provide for security throughout the world, to provide for development, to help mitigate the effects of climate change, to deal with transnational crime. I mean, all of the big, big, big problems that are actually going to affect Americans somehow involve a degree of multilateral diplomacy. So I would put that out there the first. The second is multilateral diplomacy. It's different than what we call bilateral diplomacy, like where you have an embassy and that's, you know, a relationship between two countries. Multilateral diplomacy involves working with large numbers of countries, building coalitions, convincing countries to join us in solving problems. And it's just a different skill set. And it's one that I think our country has not done as good a job as compared to other countries, including some of our adversaries who are very good at multilateral diplomacy. The other point I'd say at the outset is, like, specifically looking at the United Nations system. The United Nations and the various bodies and organs of this beast, they loom larger in the foreign policy vision of every other country compared to us. You know, for us, we have lots of places to go to change things in the world, to make our opinions known. We have the G7, we have the G20, we have NATO, we have our Indo-Pacific Quad Alliance. I mean, we have all these different tools of leverage and places where we can show up. But for most countries in the world, especially smaller countries, the UN is extremely important. It is the one place where they plug into important questions of global policymaking. And we always fail to notice that. Like, it's just not on our horizon. And, you know, let's just be really frank. I think Americans in general have a really difficult time seeing the world the way the rest of the world sees the world. And Americans have a really difficult time seeing ourselves through the eyes of other countries, especially poorer countries, countries in the global South. And that's why, you know, I mean, I can go down the list of the things Americans get from the multilateral system. And I think it's important to, you know, constantly be repeating this. You know, we have systems that monitor human rights around the world and shine a spotlight on abusers. We have systems for burden sharing so that when we're dealing with crises, whether it's the refugee crisis, whether it's the climate crisis, that we're working together to solve problems. And we have systems of law, like the Charter of the United Nations, that Russia has just so, you know, egregiously violated, systems that keep all countries a little bit safer. So I can go through that and, you know, sort of give that list. And in my job at the White House, that was really important for me to do when I would speak to others. But I think one aspect of multilateral diplomacy, the thing that fascinates me the most, is American diplomats at the UN tend to come to understand the world and see the world in some really, really insightful ways that Washington often misses.
Yeah.
They detect trends, they understand resentments, and it's like multilateral diplomacy. It's like these corrective goggles for American diplomats to really see the world through the eyes of other countries. Sounds very basic, but when you're a diplomat at the UN, whether it's in New York, the UN bodies in Geneva, some of the other multilateral capitals, your job is literally to sit in a room, you sit in a chair, and you listen to foreign people talk for a long time.
A long time sometimes.
A long time, all day sometimes. And I think that, you know, Americans, I think we're better off when we listen a little bit more. And that is something that you don't have a choice to do when you're a multilateral diplomat. And so I think that understanding that better would help American foreign policy just generally and avoid some of the blind spots that we have when we see the world.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite things actually about working on UN issues, was getting feedback from our colleagues in New York, because of course, you know, there's Washington sitting here and kind of we're negotiating internally and coming up with what we think is an acceptable position on an issue. And then we're sharing that with New York, and New York is telling us what's actually possible to achieve. And they're feeding back information into our system on tactics and how we can actually approach those issues. And so I found that really interesting and rewarding. And I think what you're also getting at is the idea that we need more humility in how we practice maybe our foreign policy. And I've thought so much about this because ever since grad school, I've been thinking about American exceptionalism, this idea of American exceptionalism, and how on the one hand, national pride and a sense of pride and investment in our ideals and our values is so important in terms of serving as kind of a beacon, something that we have to orient ourselves toward and continuously pursue. But it doesn't mean we're perfect or that we've achieved everything that we want to achieve. And I think sometimes that vision, that identity gets in the way of being reflective and maybe kind of seeing ourselves, as you said, the way that others in the world see us, the way that we could see ourselves if we were more committed to, you know, being able to be humble enough and say, we're not maybe stellar at everything, and that's okay. And that's part of the process of growing and leading and learning and listening. And so I am heartened by the fact that so many people I talk to kind of say the same thing. And I think we will get there, but it's going to take some time and it's going to be a challenge.
Well, just kind of two points in response to that. One, on the humility.
Yeah.
I think one of the best examples that I can think of was the Ukraine war. The Ukraine war happened. And I mean, this was a totally clear-cut, straightforward violation of the Charter of the United Nations, right? We were outraged. And I think in the weeks and months after the invasion, there was an assumption that the rest of the world would share our outrage in the exact same way. And I will give Ambassador Thomas Greenfield enormous credit for very, very early on. She was picking up some interesting signals from her conversations. She was literally doing listening tours to hear what other countries were thinking. Another country, I mean, no country really loved what Russia was doing, right? Like, Russia didn't have a lot of support for its invasion. But what countries were saying to her was, hey, you know, this is a regional war in Europe. My region has wars too. Like, I'm more focused on that. Or they'd say, look, you know, yeah, this is not a good thing, but that Putin's doing, but Russia's invasion is increasing food prices in my country. So I just want this war over at all costs. I don't care on what terms, because this is existential for me that bread now costs a lot more. And then, and this is a little uncomfortable for us as Americans, you sometimes would hear countries say, oh, you, the United States, the country of the 2003 Iraq invasion, the country of Guantanamo Bay, you know, list all your other historical sins, you're suddenly discovering, you know, justice and morality in international affairs. And some of our European colleagues were particularly tone deaf on this because they would go to some of their former colonial possessions, you know, with a real painful historical legacy. And they would say, you know, why aren't you more outraged? Why aren't you doing more to hold Russia accountable? Again, not having that sense of self-awareness. The second point I make in terms of, you know, how we talk about us and our country, I think one of the biggest differences between the Obama years and the Biden years was when we talked about human rights, it was definitely a different tone. It was a much more humble tone. Remember, we came into office just a couple weeks after the January 6th insurrection that the whole world saw. We also, you know, came into office at a time of a lot of deep thinking and reckoning on our difficult racial history. And so it just wasn't tenable for us to go into a room and say, you know, be like us, we're awesome.
Right.
We needed to have a different tone. And so one thing Secretary Blinken did in the very first months, he invited to the United States, he made a standing invitation for different UN special rapporteurs. These are monitors that monitor different aspects of human rights. So there's a special rapporteur focused on gender, LGBTQ issues, police brutality, all of these, you know, various thematic human rights topics. He said, we invite these monitors here. We will introduce them to our local communities so that they can observe our record. And our record is not always going to be perfect, but that's fine because we're a confident democracy and we can handle criticism. And by the way, that's not how China is. That's not how authoritarian countries are. It was actually a really good way of both signaling that we were reflective, that we were humble, but also drawing a distinction between us and some of our adversaries who have really disturbing human rights.
Actually records. Walking the walk, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I do have to say, you know, you mentioned the word exceptionalism, which American exceptionalism, that's a very loaded term. Mm-hmm. And I think it's usually interpreted to mean the rules don't apply to us. And, you know, I understand that. And I think we need to understand better that the rules do apply to us. And that's the world we're trying to create. And the same time, I think, though, it is appropriate and good to be very proud of some of the things the United States brings to the table. I mean, ultimately, the whole UN system was inspired by our democratic traditions. The charter of the UN was inspired by our constitution. It was Americans, it was American values that were pumped into this organization. And that's a really good record of which we, I think, can be proud. So we've made some pretty serious mistakes, But we've also stood up for some very, very important principles and have expended a lot of energy and national treasure to do so. So yeah. As a U.S. diplomat at the U.N., I was proud to represent the United States, assuming that we were on the right course and right. standing on our principles.
And all these things can be true at the same time, right? I think Absolutely. Like holding space for all these truths is super important, and it's the only way to kind of move forward in a clear-eyed way. Now, I can't believe we only have a few minutes left because I feel like I could talk to you all day and there's so many cool issues we could get into, but I want to come back to your life as a public servant. What's one thing that you think that you have sacrificed for this life and this journey? And also, what's one really special thing you've gained that maybe you wouldn't have had in a different career or a different life?
As you know from your time in government, and I think as most federal government workers know, working in federal government can be kind of hard. The conditions are not great. The pay is okay, but you're often dealing with some brilliant, talented people who could be making a lot more money in the private sector. So you're sacrificing certain your financial future to a certain degree. You're sacrificing a lot of opportunities that you could have if you were, again, not to knock anyone in the private sector. I did it for several years. It's great. It's fantastic. But when you work in government, in addition to salaries being lower than you could probably get outside, you also just have to deal with a lot of dysfunction, systems mm-hmm. that don't work. Your computer doesn't work. It takes forever to get reimbursed for, a taxi ride. I mean, it's a lot of petty indignities. And some of those are things that should be fixed. I think that we should do a better job taking care of personnel in federal government. Some of it's just the nature of working in the private sector. And so I really thought about this when I came from the private sector back into government in 2021. It was a big pay cut. And it was subjecting myself to longer hours, a lot more stress, a lot more frustration. But it was actually a good experience because it reminded me that, the experiences that you have in federal government are so special. They're worth a lot of the indignities and, mm-hmm. and the annoyances. And you asked about the special moments, what I've gained from this. I go back to these two just life-defining moments, the moment when Kosovo declared its independence, and I was part of that, mm-hmm. and then the moment we got the Iran nuclear deal. That was, just to feel like you're participating in world historic events and that you're helping people and that you're helping your own country, you're serving your country. These were some of the most special memories I've ever had, and I treasure it. And working at the White House, it was the same thing. I got to take my mom to lunch in the West Wing Navy mess. That's pretty cool. Riding on Air Force One, that's something you don't get to do every day. And so those kind of experiences were so meaningful and so fun that it makes all of the sacrifices worth it.
Did you get to bowl in the White House bowling alley?
Absolutely. No, that's one of the greatest perks.
Yeah. Of course. So then looking ahead, what's your greatest hope for the near future, the intermediate future, however you want to think about that?
Well, I think we just need to be really honest about the moment that we're in, mm-hmm. Where you have some people in the current administration who I think truly in their bones do not understand what motivates people to pursue careers in public service. Obviously, we've seen these mass firings, often done under very humiliating conditions, people locked out of their offices and computers. And not only have there been these mass firings, but it's been done in a way that has been exceptionally cruel. That's been the point, right?
Right.
It's not enough to blow up the U.S. Agency for International Development. They have done it in a way that suggests there's crime and fraud and, ideology run amok. And USAID, I think, is particularly personal for me because at every phase of my career, I've worked closely with development and humanitarian assistance professionals at USAID, and to have them go through that. I mean, these are the best people I know, you know, who have dedicated their lives to living in dangerous and difficult places to help others. So I think it's a really dark moment. And, you know, I think it was particularly interesting with USAID because the Trump administration knew there's not a big domestic constituency for USAID. There's not a lot of folks out there who understand what it does, let alone are going to be bothered with it disappearing. Right. So I think that as we think about how to get through this moment, there just needs to be a spirit of democratic renewal in this country where we go back to the idea that we're all in this together and that pitting people against other people, division, cruelty, hatred, that's just not going to get us to where we need to go as a country. I talked about, you know, my career in federal government service, but there are so many other ways that people can serve their communities. And seeing that work is not just acceptable, but is just the highest calling to give back to your community. I think we have a ways to go, but I don't see us getting out of this mess without renewing that spirit and really infusing all of our institutions, even some of our creaky institutions that, you know, don't work that well, but bringing a sense of the best, the brightest, the most motivated Americans, they should want to come and serve the country.
Absolutely. And I think for a new generation of public servants who will be signing on to these careers, recognizing that they may not be as secure as people once thought, but that you do it for the passion, for the love of country, for the will and the desire to contribute whatever skills and experiences you have to this big project of our democracy. I think that spirit is always there, and hopefully we can be a part of making something that's constructive and creative and inspired. And that is what inspired me to start this podcast. I'm like, what can I do? What can I do that's good? I need something good in my day, and I need something good in other people's days too. So I hope this has been a good part of your day, Josh, because I've been looking forward to talking to you for a while. I've admired you for years, and I'm really thankful to have had the opportunity to work with you and learn from you as such a believer in multilateralism.
Excellent. Kate, well, look, thank you so much for what you're doing and the spirit that you're bringing to this exercise. This is needed now more than ever. You've been a great colleague. I hope we can stay in touch. And who knows? I hope somewhere we may be colleagues again someday.
I hope so, too. Thanks, Josh.